Naboth's Vineyard by E.F. Benson, narrated by Trevor O'Hare. Ralph Hatchard had for the last 20 years been making a very good income at the bar. No one could marshal facts so tellingly as he. No one could present a case to a jury in so persuasive and convincing a way, nor make them see the situation he pictured to them with so sympathetic an eye. He disdained to awaken sentiment by moving appeals to humanity, for he had not, either in his private or his public life, any use for mercy, but demanded mere justice for his client. Many were the cases in which, not by distorting the facts, but merely by focusing them for the 12 intelligent men whom he addressed, he had succeeded in making them look through the telescope of his mind and see at the end of it precisely what he wished them to see. But if he had been asked of which out of all his advocacies he was most intellectually proud, he would probably have mentioned one in which that advocacy had not been successful. This was in the famous Raxton case of 7 years ago, in which he had defended a certain solicitor, Thomas Raxton, on a charge of embezzlement and conversion to his own use of the money of a client. As the case was presented by the prosecution, it seemed as if any defense would merely waste the time of the court. But when the speech for the defense was concluded, most of them who had heard it, not the public alone, but the audience of trained legal minds, would probably have betted, had betting been permitted in a court of justice, that Thomas Raxton would be acquitted. But the 12 intelligent men were among the minority, and after being absent from court for 3 hours had brought in a verdict of guilty. A sentence of 7 years was passed on Thomas Raxton, and his counsel, thoroughly disgusted that so much ingenuity should have been thrown away, felt, ever afterward, a sort of contemptuous irritation with him. The irritation was rendered more acute by an interview he had with Raxton after sentence had been passed. His client raged and stormed at him for the stupidity and lack of skill he had shown in his defense. Hatchard was a bachelor. He had little opinion of women as companions, and it was enough for him in town when his day's work was over to take his dinner at the club, and after a stern rubber or two at bridge, to retire to his flat, and more often than not work at some case in which he was engaged till the small hours. Apart from the dinner table and the card table, the only companion he wanted was an opponent at golf for Saturday and Sunday, when he went down for his weekend to the seaside links at Scarling. There was a pleasant dormy house in town, at which he put up, and in the summer he was accustomed to spend the greater part of the long vacation here, renting a house in the neighborhood. His only near relation was a brother who had civil service appointment at Bareilly, in the northwest province of India, whom he had not seen for some years, for he spent the hot season in the hills and but seldom came to England. Hatchard got from acquaintances all the friendship that he needed, and though he was a solitary man, he was by no means to be described as a lonely one, for loneliness implies the knowledge that a man is alone, and his wish that it were otherwise. Hatchard knew he was alone, but preferred it. His golf and his bridge of an evening gave him all the companionship he needed. A further recreation of his was botany. Plants are good to look at, they're interesting to study, and they don't bore you by unwished-for conversation, would have been his manner of accounting for so unexpected a hobby. He intended, when he retired from practice, to buy a house with a good garden in some country town, where he could enjoy at leisure this trinity of innocuous amusements. Till then, there was no use in having a garden from which his work would sever him for the greater part of the year. He always took the same house at Scarling when he came to spend his long vacation there. It suited him admirably, for it was within a few doors of the local club, where he could get a rubber in the evening and find a match at golf for next day, and the motor omnibuses that plied along the seaside road to the links passed his door. He had long ago settled in his mind that Scarling was to be the home of his late and leisured years, and of all the houses in that compact medieval little town, the one which he most coveted lay close to that which he was now accustomed to take for the summer months. Opposite his windows ran the long red brick wall of its garden, and from his bedroom above he could look over this and see the amenities which in its present proprietorship seemed so sadly undervalued. An acre of lawn with a gnarled and sprawling mulberry tree lay there. A pergola of rambler roses separated this from the kitchen garden, and all round in the shelter of the walls which defended them from the chill northerly and easterly blast lay deep flower beds. A paved terrace faced the garden side of Telford House, but weeds were sprouting there, the grass of the lawn had been suffered to grow long and rank, and the flower beds were an untended jungle. The house, too, seemed exactly what would suit him. It was of Queen Anne date, and